There is a peacefulness here in this room that's difficult to be aware of if we are preoccupied in other thoughts and things, feelings. It's also difficult sometimes to feel, be aware of, if it's become habituated, if you've gotten used to it. Sometimes when people come into this room for the first time, there's a feeling of peacefulness and stillness here. It's quite nice. But then they do a retreat, and it's busy, and it just kind of, it becomes normal, and people come in quickly and don't notice so much. When we first bought this building, and this second floor of the building was completely unfinished. It was basically three very big rooms, or not even rooms, spaces, with plywood floors and 2x4 framing. And we walked all over the building, trying to see where should the meditation hall be. And every time someone came here, right in this area of this room, this was a much bigger space then. Everyone would go, oh, here is the place. And it seemed a little bit counterintuitive to have a meditation hall on the second floor. But there was something about this spot, even before we built the meditation hall around this space, that had a peacefulness to it. And around the same time we met the woman who lived next door, owned the house next door. She'd been living there for 35, 40 years with her husband, and she said they used to walk around this forest, little forest that was right here before this building was built. And they said to us, we used to walk around right here, and we would tell each other, this would be a great place for a meditation center. So here we are. And there's some degree of peacefulness here. And that peace that's here is multifaceted. And some of what we feel here is partly what peace is the absence of conflict. Maybe the absence of fear, agitation. And some of the ways that people feel peace by coming to a place like this can be very much in contrast to what they're used to, what their experience has been. There was one woman who came, who wrote a letter to Spirit Rock after being on a retreat there. And she wrote that being there was the first time in her life, ever, that she felt safe, especially outdoors, walking around outside. Someone else comes to Spirit Rock and it never occurs to them that that's not a place where they associate with, that's, you know, because they don't have an experience of living that way. But there are dimensions or aspects of peace that's here. And it's possible to be nourished by it or take it in and take in the peace that's here, the peace that you feel that's here, if it's the case. And let it take it in such a way that it becomes nourishment. The Buddha talked about peace as being a kind of a nourishment. Kind of a food. But it can be counterintuitive to take that in, to let it register and experience it. There are many reasons why we don't take it in, don't allow ourselves to experience it, and don't validate it, don't think it's important, don't think it's anything, or, you know, or just you know, it's... But allow ourselves to experience it to some degree, whatever modicum of way we can is helpful. So I bring up the topic of peace because it's also the theme for today, with given we're talking about the four resolves and the four are wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. And as I said the first night, I'm very fond of the word resolve because of it also means to solve. To resolve a problem is to solve it. And I like the way that all these prepositions can be put after a resolve, or resolved, you know. Resolved with, or resolved to. To be resolved to do something is to set your, make a decision and say, this is what I'm doing. It's been resolved, we're doing this. It's been solved, we're doing this. Or it's been decided, determined, we're doing this. But at least maybe in my funny brain, you know, the idea that it's kind of solved. It's kind of like there's a kind of it's kind of a ease, a relaxation. And so each of these resolves are kind of like an intention, something that we want. We want to have wisdom. We want to have truth. Maybe we want a little bit of relinquishment, if it suits us. And we want to have peace, maybe. And I think it's interesting or useful to think about this in context that we pretty much always want something. And I think that it's hard to understand. Some people, ordinary people walking around, I think it's hard to really sense and feel how the mind is usually wants something. But if you track what you think about, it's not too difficult, I think, to kind of analyze or look at your thoughts. There's probably something that qualifies as a wanting, a desire, or intention behind almost every thought, in every thought or something. Sometimes it's subtle, but it's probably there. And sometimes when go around, live our lives, sometimes there's kind of a wanting, kind of an intention in every act of seeing. You know, how often do we just see versus look? Looking being the active engagement. And I started noticing that, you know, that I would, sometimes, if I was afraid, my looking, I would look to see if it's safe and how to be safe and who's it okay to sit near. And, you know, there's a wanting there. It's kind of wanting safety. Or when I wanted, I remember many years ago, we wanted to buy a futon couch. And first I noticed that, I was surprised how many futon couches there were, futon stores there were, because I never paid any attention to it. But I also noticed, and when I was driving down, like, you know, in the city, I was looking for them. It wasn't, you know, I wanted something, the looking, wanting. Anyway, so it's, you know, there's a lot of wanting in human life that can be understood as an intention. And there can be a lot of wantings, a lot of intentions that are in cross purposes with each other, that are in conflict with each other, that are confusing. And when we start finally to look down and analyze and figure out what do we want, what's important to want, and how do we find our way in this life, it can be hard to find some intention or desire to settle on, that this is what I want to do. And it can be even more confusing when you come to Buddhism, and the kind of the message some people get is you're not supposed to have any desires. Well, you know, not only can't figure out what I'm supposed to want, but now I'm not even supposed to want, and wanting, not wanting, and, you know. And then what is it that, you know, then we discover, you know, some people only when they get older in life, but discover that some of the things they wanted, some of the things they set their life on, didn't offer up the promise that, or the expectation that we had for it. certain job was going to do it, certain amount of money was going to do it, certain house was going to do it, certain partner was going to do it, certain something, you know, just something was going to be it. And then people realize, you know, this is not, I don't know if I want to live my life based on these values or these purposes. They don't make sense. And so, you know, so there's a looking around, what's important? What do we base our life on? And so these ideas are the four resolves, or the four determinations, four, you know, basic places to stand, I think are kind of reliable intentions to have. They're, you know, in the all the different chaos of our life, we can rely on these things. These are reliable intentions to have. The intention, resolve, for wisdom. And wisdom is not a knowledge that some of you carry with you, you know something and then you apply it. Wisdom is a process of discovery. It's an kind of intelligence, discerning, knowing how to kind of figure out and see and understand. Mindfulness, through mindfulness to understand and discover. Truth is reliable. To want truth, to rely on truth, to love truth, to base our life on truth. That's much more reliable than a lot of other things. And it maybe takes some, you know, a while to realize that relinquishment is a worthwhile thing to be intent on or be resolved toward. But Nikki talked very nicely about this, the minimalist movement, and I thought that was inspiring. And, you know, we can be a minimalist when it comes to our desires. Relinquish all the ones that are extra. It'd be interesting if you made a catalog of your all the different desires you had through the day and put them in two categories. The ones that are needed and the ones that are extra. Which would you think would be the longest list? And if it's extra and you spend most of your time with extra desires, unnecessary desires, maybe you have better things to do with your mind than, you know, be thinking about those things. When I was in my early 20s, I liked to go into bookstores. And I discovered one day that, or a few times, that I'd leave bookstores exhausted. You know, and I wondered why. And so I got curious, and so next time I went to the bookstore, I kind of see, what was it about bookstores? And what was tiring was not the bookstores or the books, but rather, I didn't have any money, so all I do in bookstores is go in and want. want. And I wanted a lot of books. For me, desires are really easy to have. So want. And it was all the wanting in the bookstores that was exhausting. So you can imagine how strong the wanting was for me, that I got exhausted, tired when I left the bookstore. Some people want their whole lifetime. A friend of mine wrote a book about all the people who she studied. It's kind of a study of all the people who had lived in her house since it was built in the 1800s, different people. And she came across one woman in the 1920s. She went and looked up her death certificate. I guess she may be shy. And it said, died of exhaustion. So this idea of relinquishment is something that's reliable, something that's worth resolving on. And then today, resolved on peace. Peace. And I wonder what some of the models or role models you've had for peace in your life. One of the role models for me was my great-grandmother. I was lucky enough to know her. And I lived kind of with her for 3 months. When I was about 20, I went back to Norway where I was born, and she lived in a little narrow, little, tight, wooden apartment building, three stories high, little place. It is, and a very, very narrow, steep stairs going up. They were dark. And she lived on the second floor. And my grandfather lived on the third floor. He'd lived there his whole life. He was born there. One of the few times he left was when he was in prison camp, at the Nazi prison camps, when the Nazis took over Norway, and he was involved in the resistance. And my great-grandmother and my mother, who was alive then, had been sent out to the countryside. And so my great-grandmother had lived in this house much of her life, and she lived in this little two little rooms, a teeny kitchen. She had a bedroom, little bedroom, and she had a little room, and kind of was, she had a little, she had a little chair, like a recliner chair, and a little table, round table, and a little dining room table in that room. And there was a lot of lace. Maybe she had knit it or made it, this white lace. And she had, she was kind of a little bit nice, and if you've been to, I don't know if you've been to Minnesota, maybe you know this Norwegian type. But anyway, she was quite old, in my mind, my great-grandmother. And I'd go, she would sit there in her recliner, just not read, just sit there. And she had all her faculties, as far as I could tell. And sometimes I'd go sit with her and a little bit talk with her. But I didn't really care to talk to her, because she was so peaceful. And to for me, I just drank in her peacefulness. I hadn't really experienced someone who wasn't trying to get anything or want anything or require anything of me, or anyone who seemed to have expectations of me or judge me in any kind of way. Or she was just like, just there, peaceful. And I felt this, you know, profound peace going to this little room with her, and through her little lace, and it's quite something for me to feel that and take it in. I don't know what all she'll experience through her life, but here she is. I don't really know how peaceful she was on the inside, but this is what I experienced. Or are there places where we experience peace? Maybe because I'm Norwegian, most Norwegians live along the coast, so water is a big part of their lives. So one of the things that's really soothing for me is the peacefulness of still water. And especially at dawn, to get up in a quiet, still morning when there's no wind, and be at the edge of the water, just look out and see the complete, you know, glass-like stillness of the water. In the early morning, before things have woken up, before people have started their busy lives and things are happening, just there's this stillness and quiet. And I took my little son up to Yosemite many years ago. Maybe he was 4 or 5, and we went, I don't know if you know Yosemite, but there's a vernal pools above that, there's a lake. And it was had this wonderful, still, peaceful, quiet stillness. And I sat him down next to me to look at the lake. I said, you know, take a look at this lake, I said. Now close your eyes and try to remember the image of it. Now open it and look again and close your eyes and see if you can remember, so it becomes a memory for you. And this peacefulness. I was trying to get some good memory in there. I did it a couple of times, and he looked at me like, what in the world are you doing? As far as I know, that didn't go over. I don't think I harmed him. And also at dawn, there's something about the transition time. So for me, the dawn of dusk, dawn, the water, stillness, quiet. That's very, very peaceful. That seems to, for me, penetrate inside. I said, you know, that I didn't really have, I had an atheist upbringing, no religious upbringing whatsoever. So it was a bit of a surprise when I walked into a little chapel in France when I was 19. So a 1,000-year-old stone chapel. And this tremendous peace descended, or I don't know how to say it, it's just like it was there in this room in a way I'd never had experience before. And I lingered as much as I could to breathe in the peace, the peacefulness, the settledness. So Buddhism is associated with peace. The experience of freedom, liberation, awakening is the synonym for it is peace, profound peace. And, you know, it is a kind of a positive noun, the thing, like peace. But perhaps it's best to see it mostly as the absence of conflict, the absence of agitation, the absence of fear. And we have that capacity, we have that ability. The heart has the ability to experience the absence of conflict and peace and fear. And it's remarkable how much we can be in conflict with the world. Even if we don't think of ourselves in conflict, but it doesn't take much to think of it in those terms. Some people are in conflict with themselves and with parts of themselves. Some people are in conflict with others. Some people are in conflict with reality. And most of the rest of us are in conflict with all three, one way or the other. But to be, you know, I was certainly in conflict with myself growing up and in my early 20s, feeling there were parts of me that I didn't like, they were wrong, they were bad, they were embarrassing, that I couldn't let other people know. I was in conflict with other people because I didn't want them to know who I was, keeping them at arm's distance. Afraid of people, afraid of their judgments, afraid of what they do. I had been a victim of violence when I was a teenager, and so the fear of, you know, other people and strangers. And then conflict with reality. Not wanting things to change, or not wanting things to stay the same, wanting things to be different, not accepting what was happening, that was happening, and then accepting the changing of what's happening. It's a kind of a conflict, kind of a tension that exists. So growing up, I had these contrasts between times of peace, experience of peace, role models of peace, and I had my inner turmoil. And then I came to do this practice, and one of the things that started to happen was that before I started, in my mind, before I recognized that I was becoming a little more peaceful, I started to have memories of my grandmother, memories of experiences as a child that I hadn't thought about for years. Memories of this peacefulness, this fullness, this settledness, this sense of safety. That, you know, it's kind of nice, recovered memories kind of good things, nice things. And then over time, I started also, as I've talked about before, a lot of my early practice was not really doing very much, it was mostly not undoing, just being there and being present. And the consequence of that was learning how not to be in conflict with anything. And I would see how I was in conflict with my knee that was hurting. I was in conflict with, sometimes with my mind, conflict with, you know, all kinds of things. Once when I was, you know, there's all these wonderful, I hope you don't mind, the wonderful war stories of Zen. or something. And I was sitting in the Zendo at Green Gulch, and they had we did this 7-day sessions like this. But the last sitting of the meditation of the evening, back then, the custom was that they wouldn't ring the bell to end the sitting. What they would do, we'd all sit there and just wait until the abbot came. And when he came in, they would serve this hot barley molasses drink, I guess to fortify ourselves. And then we finished drinking it, then he would say some words, often read a poem or something. But sometimes he didn't come. But so they wouldn't ring the bell. And so we'd sit there waiting. But they wouldn't ring the bell. And, you know, but in Zen, you're not supposed to move. So if you don't move, the knees, the back, you know, it's quite something. So I was sitting there trying to deal with it, trying to cope with it, trying to be present. And after a while, it just got too much for me. I just like, and I collapsed in the most un-Zen-like way. I just like, fell, slumped down and just moved my legs and sort of collapsed. But the thing was that I was sitting right in directly in front of the door. And just in that moment, the abbot opened the door. Guess what he saw? And then I went, so I just managed to get back to my room, and then I sobbed. I sobbed and sobbed. There's so much shame, so much embarrassment, so much tension, so much going on. And then some years later, I went to Thailand to do my first Vipassana retreat, my accidental Vipassana retreat. And I was given a little kuti, a little cabin in the edge of the monastery, kind of a somewhat primitive monastery. And I was told to, this is your schedule, sit and walk, do meditation all day long, and then, and sit and walk, and then come and see me once a day, the abbot said. So I did that, and then one day, for reasons I have no idea, I decided to just go take a look around the monastery, see where I was, and walk around. Something like that. And so there I was walking around a little bit, and lo and behold, who should walk by but the abbot? And I was supposed to be meditating, so this was like a major transgression, in my mind. Uh-oh. And he, I don't know how far away he was from me. Maybe he was 40 feet away, 60, 50 feet away. We were kind of going perpendicular to each other. And he turned and he looked at me and he clearly saw me. And I had the feeling he saw me, but he also just saw right through me. There was not a ripple of thought, as far as I could tell, or idea in his mind. He had no reaction, no judgment, like nothing for him. A person, like he was looking at a tree or walking by or something, and it was like, what? I just broke the rules. I just blew it. And he didn't have a ripple of any concern or any kind of judgment, and to have that experience of me so clearly, what all the things I was doing inside were all projections of what I thought he was doing, and then have the experience or the sense that he was doing nothing. He had no agitation, no ripples in his mind, the fact that there was this person walking around the monastery, and was actually quite freeing for me. For one thing, I saw how much it was all a product of my own mind. I made it all up. He didn't share it at all. I was projecting it on him. So it helped me to kind of see what the projections I did, the thoughts, the inner world that I lived in. And that seeing that was the beginning of being able to put it down, and not be so caught in it. And I think that if we think of peace as the absence of conflict, then I think that's what makes it reliable. I don't know if we make peace a thing that we hold on to and try to make be, I think then it becomes fragile because, but the absence of something, you know, it's not a, you can't make or be or hold on to an absence. It's just an absence. So an absence of conflict is reliable. Is it reliable? Because a lot of people are in conflict, and then people say, well, I'm not, people are in conflict with me, therefore I'm in conflict. The Buddha said, others are in conflict with me, but I am not in conflict with them. That's quite an interesting statement. The fact that other people have conflict with you, does that mean that you have a conflict with them? Maybe sometimes not. Does it require a conflict in return? Or is it a mindset, to the mindset of conflict, a mindset of aggression, of being? Conflict means, literally in Latin, means to strike together, to inflict conflict. And can we take care of ourselves? Can we make ourselves safe in the world without being in conflict with others, even if people are in conflict with us? Is it possible to do that? And I've seen it done. I've seen people who, recipient of anger, intense anger, who did not pick it up as something to be in conflict with, but at the same time, not something to accept, and calmly say, this is not appropriate, you can't do this. Or I've seen people receive anger and simply didn't participate in it as if it was anger, just continue talking and almost ignored it. I've seen people be the recipient of anger and bow and walk away. Were they in conflict? Conventionally, we say they're in conflict because maybe conventionally we think as soon as there's some tension between people, but maybe the tension sometimes is only in one direction. And I wonder how many times we buy into it. How many times do we then take it in as being something that we have to then respond to in kind? I've known people who, their policy is if someone says something to me that's mean or angry or something, I'm always going to meet them with what, give them back what they give me. And I've seen it escalate. So the aggressor, you know, starts it, and then the recipient meets it, and so the aggressor goes higher. So just until I saw once a shouting match. I don't think it was useful for anyone. Is there another way? Is there another way? What is it to be resolved on peace or non-conflict? So just as it's, you know, I think as I, now the third time I'm saying it, that I think that it's not so useful to think of peace as a thing, as a state that we have to hold on to, or that we're supposed to be peaceful. One of the ways of studying, learning how to be peaceful, is to study what makes us unpeaceful. To become aware of what causes us to be agitated or enter conflict. And one of the great ways of studying that is to have some experiences in your life that gives you some modicum of peace, of calm, of non-agitation, of subtleness. So it could be your meditation practice, if you have a practice, regular practice or something. And maybe you get calmer when you meditate. Maybe you're a little more peaceful than how you normally are. And rather than holding on to the peace, the calm, the thing to do is go on to do what's next, that's when your practice really begins. The practice is not about getting peaceful. The real practice is noticing how you lose it. Notice what gets in the way, what agitates it. That's where we'll learn the really important stuff about ourselves. So you're peaceful and relaxed, and you get up, and then you notice that, here in the retreat center, that it's getting time for lunch. And the idea of being the first person in lunch line, or early in that lunch line, not at the end of that long line, is so important that you get impatient with the person going down the steps slowly. And you're kind of looking to see how you can get around them. And then you're in conflict with that person, and you're rushing. And in the rush and impatience, you've lost your peace that you had. Maybe you can see that much more clearly because you have the contrast between the peace and then the agitation. It's not wrong that you did that, but it is interesting to study it and to know how that works. And then if you get to know better and better how this works, then you can ask yourself an important question. Is it worthwhile to sacrifice your peace to get further ahead at the lunch line at IRC? Is it worthwhile to be impatient? Why is this person going so slow? And I should need to write a letter to the IRC and talk about, have a minimum speed sign for going down the steps. And get all kind of worked up is it worth sacrificing the peace for that? I chose that example because I was hoping that was such a clear example, you'd say, no, it's not worth sacrificing your peace just to be further ahead on the line. That seems pretty clear. So that's a lesson that can be learned. Some of those lessons are harder to learn. You might be debating with yourself, of course I should give up my peace for that. I have to take care of people, I have responsibilities, I have, all kinds of things. But I think the challenge, one of the real good challenges to receive from Buddhism, is the challenge that maybe there is nothing that's worth sacrificing your peace. Maybe there's nothing that's worth giving up your state of non-conflict. Even if you have to step into a situation where other people are in conflict, and you're stepping in to make a difference and help, but you don't have to enter into it with a sense of conflict. So that's a wonderful kind of standard. You don't have to agree with what I said, but it's kind of like a little idea, a reference point to help with the questioning, help the looking. What's going on here? What am I sacrificing my peace for? Is it worthwhile losing it? And maybe sometimes you'll say it is worthwhile. But to explore and get to know yourself better this way. And one of the definitions of a wise person in the early tradition, maybe I said this earlier, a wise person is someone who understands how they get caught. And the reason why that's, in the earliest teachings of Buddhism, that's the primary understanding of what a wise person is someone who knows how they get caught, knows how they get caught up in their suffering and their attachments. And one of the reasons why that's such a reliable source of wisdom, if you know how you get caught, then you can avoid getting caught. But if you don't know how you get caught, how can you avoid it? And what some people do is they hold on to states of peace, they hold on to wonderful states of being, and think, I have it made. And they try to get back to there right away, bypassing the difficult work of getting to understand themselves. What's going on here? And then if we understand ourselves, understand how we get caught, understand how we're in conflict, understand the challenges we have, the ways the mind works, and then can we not be in conflict with that? Can we not be add criticism or see it as bad or wrong. Because one of the characteristics of the Dharma is that the goal should be reflected, or the means should reflect the goal, or the goal should be reflected in the means. If the goal is to be peaceful, then the means to be peaceful, to become peaceful, is to start not being in conflict with things, to not cause harm. So how is it we can enter into a deeper knowing of ourselves and see all the shadow sides and the difficult sides and the sides that, you know, in some ways we wish wasn't there? How can we see it in a way there's no conflict with it, that we don't cause more harm in seeing it? Can we be peaceful in a certain kind of a some kind of way with what's here? Can we hold it in a generous way, in a non-agitated way, non-conflictive way? And it's possible that sometimes that's the most profound aspect of this whole work, is not resolving our problems, but resolving to be peaceful about them. Our psychological challenges and difficulties and attachments and fears, to resolve on being peaceful or spacious or equanimous with their presence. A reference point that sometimes I've used in my life is my memories of sitting at the edge of water at dawn, peaceful and still, and great expanse of water going out. This tremendous peace that's there. What is that flat, expanse of water? Think about my guilt or my shame or my anger or my sadness. I've looked at the water. Wow, that water has lots of space for me to be this way. Can I have as much space in my heart, my mind for it, as the water does, as this ocean has? How big can you be? Can you make yourself really big? Vast. So that what's inside is not, you know, not such a big deal. It's like, it's just there as phenomena of nature. We don't have to identify with it, or we don't have to make it as me, myself, and mine. We don't have to be claustrophobic around it. A preoccupied mind, a mind that's caught up in thoughts and ideas and fears and agitations and angers and desires, tends to be claustrophobic. There's very little room. And then because there's very little room, everything magnified in how important it is. But if there's lots of room in the mind, lots of room in the heart for all this stuff, lots of breathing room for everything, then it isn't as important in one way, not so important in terms of defining me, myself, and mine, but maybe it becomes important in another way. It becomes important as one more manifestation of nature. Wow. There I am. I'm angry. I'm afraid. But there's so much space for it. There's so much room. Someone threw a little pebble into the big lake, big ocean, and made a little ripple. And wow, look at that ripple. Look at that. This is it's manifestation of nature in this way, at this moment. It has a certain importance, and just it's a certain kind of reality. We don't want to be disrespectful of it, but it puts it in, you know, the space and being big for it. puts in a different context. There's a vast ocean of peace that has, that can hold it, that can just let it be there. We don't have to pick it up, we don't have to push it away. It was a wonderful surprise for me when, in the context of practicing like this, like you are here on retreat, I was doing walking meditation. And I was walking back, I had my walkway, you know, back and forth. You know, I'd staked it out. And I'd used it several days in a row. It's clearly mine, right? So I was walking back and forth, and then it was a long hallway. And this guy came walking from far into the hallway, was walking down, and kind of in, you know, kind of right along the same line which I was walking. And I thought, well, surely he knows this is where my place. I'm walking back, I've walked back a number of times while he was walking down. And so certainly when he gets close, he'll just go around me. Nope. And so I came to the end of my walkway, I turned around, and he was like halfway in my walkway. I mean, this was pretty serious. On the scale of things that happen on a retreat, this is like, this is worth losing your peace over. And so I got angry. But there was so much room for the anger, there's so much space, that I had kind of like a Teflon mind. It's just like the anger arose, and it just kind of like a, you know, if you let go of the balloon, you know, that your helium balloon, it just floats up, just float right up and disappeared. So there was no denying I was angry, but that didn't, you know, I wasn't holding on to the balloon, and the helium just like took it wherever it takes. Anger balloons, I don't know where they go. So I wasn't troubled by that moment of anger. I didn't think it was a bad thing to have. It's just like, it wasn't a good thing to have. It was, I didn't have any judgments about it. Just, I was just amazed. Well, look at that. So I have lots of room. So this idea of that space, room, is part of the peacefulness. What does it take to have lots of room for your experience? Lots of space, breathing room. In the teachings of the Buddha, he specifically talked about that one of the ways to experience peace is not to view things through the filter, through the perspective of me, myself, and mine. And I think this is one of the common kind of subjects of almost all people's thoughts, that we're a player, we're an actor, we're a character in our own drama, our own stories we're telling, the desires we have, what we want, how we want. And so there's so much self-referencing going on. And it's not wrong to do that. Just because Buddhism kind of highlights it as being a source of suffering doesn't mean that you're a bad person because you do that at all. It's just that it's an ouch. And one of the advantages of this kind of subtleness, peacefulness that we do here in retreat, where so much of the social concerns in life falls away, that it's easier to see the ouch or the exhaustion that comes from being involved in thoughts of me, myself, and mine. Just like for me, I saw the exhaustion of the bookstore, wanting. So the constant self-referencing that goes on is a great limitation. It's one of the ways to get contracted, to live in a small world. And so is there some way of the activity of the mind, the thinking of the mind, the constructs of the mind around me, myself, and mine, is it okay to let that be put to rest, at least temporarily, to give it a vacation, to take a little bit of risk, a little bit of a experiment? What would it be like if you gave yourself a vacation from self, from selfing? And I'm confident that some of you, it's inconceivable even what that would look like, as it was for me. But it is possible. It's completely possible to be present, to be awake, to be aware, to be able to take care of yourself without that central hold or grasping or central kind of contraction or consolidation that comes along with me, myself, and mine. I. And so for the Buddha, the ultimate peace, the kind of the profoundest, most profound experience of non-conflict, the most profound experience of peace that's possible, comes when we see through and be able to put to rest the attachments and clinging and preoccupation with me, myself, and mine. And what's that like? Maybe it's a little bit like the peacefulness of this room. Maybe it's a little bit like the space, stillness that's within this room. There's more space in this room than there are people and objects. So to have some peace, and to use that as a reference point, to be attentive to how you lose it, and to question that. Is it really necessary? What's going on there? To have some inkling, some sense, even the slightest little sense of what it's like to be peaceful, and have that kind of be a seasoning in your mindfulness. Mindfulness is kind of like the womb of peace. Mindfulness is a place where peace can grow. Can you bring a quality of peacefulness or non-conflict into how you're mindful and aware? And to be resolved on peace. To take a kind of a stand on non-conflict. Or to say it differently, to have that be a guide, a reliable guide for how to find our way through this challenging human life. To be guided by the possibility of peace, the possibility of non-conflict, the possibility of the heart being settled on itself, at rest in itself, so that in ourselves we feel at home. Sense of the kind of safety and fullness, maybe that sometimes comes with feeling at home in ourselves, with ourselves. A home that has no walls. A home that can include the whole world.